Okay, so this is round two with Mike Buchheit here on September the 2nd at the Embassy Suites at Biltmore in Phoenix. And Mike and Kim Buchheit have just accepted a job at the Grand Canyon. And Mike, I think we're going to hear a little bit about what your reminiscences might be about actually driving up to the canyon as a resident.
The drive to the canyon. Well, it was a...
There any like conversations? Were you
We had two cars at that point. Okay. So I had the cats.
Yeah.
So I had three cats. Was it three at the time? Yeah. And two cars, and then my cousin had a truck, and it was old school relocation. Wow. I think the NHA threw a few bucks our way for the relocation, but we did rent a U-Haul, a little mini trailer for some of the stuff. But I remember coming down the drive down to into Camp Verde when you turn that corner and you can see the San Francisco peaks, and they, you know, still had some snow, and it was like, wow, you know, it. Little did I know I'd be curling around that mountain every weekend for the next, you know, 30 years, running to town for groceries on the weekends. So I'm getting excited. And, we roll into the park. We lived on the end of Mojave Street in company housing.
So that's the place you lived for many years.
The place you and Helen took over, yeah. So a three-bedroom, two-bath, kind of a townhouse situation.
Nice.
Living, working, playing with all your coworkers. It was definitely a different environment than Phoenix, where I could be a cross-dressing lounge singer in one life and a welder in another, and never the two should meet. And up there, everybody's kind of, you know.
But that wasn't a deal breaker for you.
Oh, no. Not at all. Yeah. I was looking for a change, and I got it. But I do remember we got there, and we got a few hand loads of stuff in, and I look out of my back patio, and we were on the outer outskirts of Grand Canyon Village, the residential area, and it's just 30 miles of ponderosa forest right out the back door, and there was a coyote sitting on my back patio. So another, you know, the trickster universe still at it, and the coyote looked at me and I looked at him, and he took off, and I said, "We're not in Scottsdale anymore." Not that there aren't coyotes in Scottsdale. So it took me weeks, if not months, before I could wake up and not have to pinch myself that I'm a mile from the rim of the Grand Canyon.
And so at this time, Kim has a job.
Kim has a job.
But you do not have a job.
I don't, and I have, and I'll say this on the record, I told her I would not work until, you know, I'd take a year off until I wrote the great American novel.
Wow.
And it's still in draft form.
Well, at least you have a draft.
Two authors laughing, yeah. So, but I was a kid in a candy store. I would hike every day. And,
wow, nice.
And I had my map out.
And taking pictures, I assume?
Not quite yet.
Not quite yet.
But okay. No, that's not far away, though. And up and down the trails, just having a blast, doing some crazy day hikes. I wasn't doing many overnights.
Who were some of your first friends at Grand Canyon before you got your job?
Before I got my job?
Anybody that sticks out? Did you meet any famous hiker?
Lon Ayers.
Okay.
Some of the backcountry office folks.
Okay.
So,
all right.
So I'd be hanging out there trying to grab a permit now and then. And Lon, for sure. And
I remember Lon Ayers.
Longtime ranger.
Yeah.
In fact, he blew it for me. A little side story. So Lon is a through hiker.
Oh, yeah.
He did it in segments. And he'd do it on his furloughs. He'd get his hiking in the winter. And I remember he did a... I had my best friend from Dallas, Pete Timmerman, and his wife and two other Texas friends, Dan and Jody, and wife Kim. And we were just doing a down the Kaibab, two nights at Bright Angel, and then out the BA. And I was trying to talk it up as a real out there kind of hike. And most people listening to this know that it's pretty much... it's kind of it can be consequence free, so we bumped into Lon. We met Lon Ayers in the Redwall, hiking out, and he had just, if I remember this correctly, he had a hunch that on the top of ISIS, or no, not ISIS, the Tower of Ra, where there was, you might correct me on this, somebody in the way back time was trying to build a tram across the canyon.
Yes.
And I think there was going to be a relay station on top of Ra or Set. And they got hit with an early winter storm, and they just left all their stuff and got the hell out of there. Well, Lon thought maybe they left some stuff up there. So he had soloed that, and he was on his way back out of the canyon. And he was as animated as I ever have seen him. He's a pretty low-key guy, for those of you who know him would agree. But he said, oh, man, I was in and out of Trinity Creek, and it was overgrown, and there was ticks everywhere, and blah. And he was just going on and on and on. And he found some stuff on top. Of course, he left it, which you're legally you need to do, anybody. You know, some eyeglasses and I think a notebook, and he probably photo-documented it. And he looked like he had dropped 15 pounds. You know, I don't know how long he was out. And then he pushed on, and my friend Pete looked at me and he said, we're on a pussy hike, aren't we? And I'm like, thanks, Lon. I never got to circle back and curse him to his face for blowing my cover. Pardon that phrase, people.
That's okay.
We're all friends here.
Probably when anybody listens to this, that'll just be the vernacular.
Okay. So, that wasn't very hashtag me too, but anyway, who cares at this point. So, hiking, very little time at the keyboard, and I met a gentleman named John Fraser, husband of Pam Fraser, my wife's boss, who was the first director of the Grand Canyon Field Institute. So a quick clarification here. So I'll still refer to, for the purposes of this conversation, the Field Institute. It had a few name changes that paralleled the change from Grand Canyon Natural History Association to Grand Canyon Association to Grand Canyon Conservancy and whatever it's called now. But along the way, we would adopt the full name of the new name of the larger nonprofit and then slap Institute on that. So I had to get my tramp stamp changed, my tattoo, 3 or 4 times over. No, that's a joke. So this was the Grand Canyon Field Institute, which was the outdoor education program for the Grand Canyon Natural History Association. So that's the flag in time when I showed up. So so John had started the Field Institute at the request of the Park Service for the Natural History Association to start an outdoor education program to provide deep dive educational experiences that the rangers were not set up to do in terms of length, expertise, risk, appetite, you name it.
And as I heard you say literally 100 times or more before my guided backpacks with the Field Institute, this was the vision of the past superintendent, Bob Chandler?
Bob Chandler, right. Yeah, who had been come and gone as superintendent before my time. But he was on the board of the Natural History Association, I think when I, about the time I showed up. So it was more or less his brainchild.
Right.
And he was on trend because a lot of the the big parks out, in particular out west, with a few east of the Mississippi exceptions, like Grand Smoky or Great Smoky Mountain Institute at Tremont is a great example. But a lot of the big parks out west, all of which, like every park in the country, every national historic site, every national recreation area, every national forest, has a nonprofit partner to help them in any number of ways, which we could go into if we have some time left. So a lot of the big parks out west that had a lot of moving parts and a lot of a sprawling resource to help interpret and help their park partner manage, conserve, and illuminate the park visitors upon. Yellowstone, Rocky Mountain National Park, Yosemite, that's kind of a weird case, Olympic National Park. I think Joshua Tree already had a program up and running. So we were late into the game, especially for Crown Jewel Park.
Right.
So there were we had a lot of people that came before us that we could borrow from their models and did.
But, and I think the Field Institute of Grand Canyon started about 1993 with John Fraser as the first director.
Yeah, thank you. I kind of buried that lead. So he was the first director. So he had a few existing models to borrow from, which he did. I think he did a great job of that. And he reached out to what became some charter instructors that helped him.
Do you happen to remember if John Fraser had employment with the Natural History Association before he took this job?
He did. He was their what would today be called a warehouse manager. So the Natural History Association is one of the most of the cooperating associations. So that's this network of nonprofits that work with their host park and their senior partner have a retail operation. It could be a row of books in a visitor center, or it could be a full-blown bookstore with gifts and novelties.
Or eight bookstores, as the case may
Or eight bookstores, like the Grand Canyon Conservancy is today, which is, I think, for a nonprofit that works one-on-one with a park, I think their retail operation dwarfs most, if not all.
Okay. So, I just wondered if, you know, his wife worked there.
Yeah, Pam. Yeah.
And so they were a family deal, and just sounds like you were about to be.
Well, I'll tell you what. If you land, this will get a few chuckles for the listeners. If you're a married couple that arrive, that washes up on the south rim of, or even more so on the north rim, and you have an unemployed spouse that has housing, the HR directors will be.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Bukai, what are your qualifications?
Yeah.
I have housing. Great, you're hired.
I've got no rap sheet and a full set of teeth. You're hired. Because housing, we're joking, but housing is a real premium in Grand Canyon National Park. It's one of the few parks in the country that has employee housing within the boundaries of the park. There's very few that do. Grand Canyon's anomalous in that they have a K-12 school, which I think is the only
certainly the only high school is what I've heard.
Okay, yeah.
But
So John was the director of the Field Institute. He had created working relationships with what was then AmFac Parks and Resorts, with Babbitt's grocery store, and they're in general, but more specifically.
All these names have changed now.
Now they're Delaware North.
Delaware North. Babbitt's.
The Canyon Market. AmFac is now Zantera.
Yeah.
So we were looking for room blocks. We were looking for gear rentals for clients who are flying in from God knows where, and with Grand Canyon Railways, which is now owned and operated by Zanterra. So a lot of little piecemeal deals and handshake agreements and whatnot to try to smooth out the logistics for the suite of programs that John was putting together.
I'm just curious, when this program started, were you and Kim living at the canyon yet, or you came?
Not yet. We came shortly thereafter, yeah.
Okay.
We showed up in 94, which was their first full year.
Okay.
The Field Institute. And you could argue that was still a pilot year. They were still working the bugs out. But John realized in the fall of 94 that he needed an assistant or more.
Oh, okay.
So I interviewed during the winter holidays, and he, myself and the late Chris Crossland, shout out to Chris, were hired to split an assistant, an administrative assistant position.
How do you spell that last name?
C-R-O-S-S-L-A-N-D.
Crossland. Crossland, okay.
A longtime Grand Canyon local. He lived in Tucson.
Okay.
And geologist.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, it's amazing you guys didn't meet during this time. So we were working the phones, getting people in, getting people out. Just, you know, other duties as assigned, just getting it done.
Who are some of the charter instructors?
Okay, here comes a very short list. There might be more. So
yeah.
Krista Sadler, yeah. Andre Potoshnik, Mike Anderson, historian, Brian Bates, Carol Sue Van, now I think Carol Sue Harris. I don't know if you ever met her. Ernie Atencio, who's now the Southwest manager for the NPCA.
Okay.
And Ernie and Elspeth Atencio. Ann Zwinger, the late Ann Zwinger.
Wow.
Author and all around phenomenal person.
Yeah.
Ken Walters as a photographer.
Nice.
Yeah. We'll get back to Ken.
Yeah.
And and let's see. I apologize for anyone I'm missing, but that's a short list. Yeah.
Yeah, I recognize most of those names. Some of them I don't, but I didn't realize you had started out as an assistant sharing the job with someone else.
Yeah.
How long did that go on for?
Let's see. I think by the end of 95, we started in January 95. And I think in the summer of 95, Chris resigned, Chris Crossland, and John, I just went to full time.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's great.
Late 95.
Now you're working full time for the Field Institute as an assistant?
Yep.
Still?
Yeah.
And where was your office?
Well, let's see. It was a dreary cubicle. Oh, no, it wasn't a dreary cubicle. It was actually, cue the envy here, it was in Blanche Kolb's bedroom in the bowels of Kolb's studio on the Bright Angel Trailhead overlooking Grand Canyon.
And this was the assistant's office.
Well,
did John
have an office? Yeah, we had two desks.
Yeah, two desks, okay.
In Blanche's bedroom.
So John's wife, Pam, was very instrumental in converting the Kolb house from a bulldozing project for the Park Service to renovating it and it becoming an art gallery. And sounds like it was offices for some of the Natural History Association staff.
Yeah, so basically we were, to back up a little bit, the then and now, the main office for the Grand Canyon Natural History Association and every iteration since then is in what's referred to by old gray guys like Wayne as the clinic. So it's a historic building.
The
hospital.
The old hospital.
The old hospital, thank you.
Yeah.
It's behind the South Rim Ranger State Ranger headquarters.
Yeah.
You wouldn't find it unless you were lost.
That's
it's
right.
On a little cul-de-sac on a cul-de-sac. And so one of the competitive, well, I should, let's see. So one of the perks, if you will, for all of the many of the nonprofits that work with their agency partner is that you can operate rent-free in historic buildings in your respective parks.
Wow.
So in most cases. So our... our office was in the old the first hospital in Grand Canyon on the South Rim, which I don't know if we'll get into superintendents, but Rob Arnberger, famous Superintendent Arnberger, who was one of my four or five superintendents, was famously delivered there as a baby.
Yeah.
When his dad was a head ranger,
yeah, something
or chief
like
ranger, something like that,
maybe in the 30s.
Yeah. So, how did I get down that rabbit hole?
Well, we were just talking
about... Oh, Culp Studio.
Yeah, Culp
so,
Studio.
So we were then and now office space was a real premium. So the Park Service agreed to allow the Field Institute to inhabit the residential area of Culp Studio, which is... with rare exceptions, closed to the public.
Yeah.
And it was at that point unfurnished. So we had classes, we were launching classes, orienting people and launching out of Culp Studio and welcoming people back off the trail, oftentimes caked in mud.
In Emery Kolb's dining room.
In his dining room. And then answering phones and wringing hands and, you know, replacing gauze and restocking.
I didn't come to the Field Institute until 1999 at your gracious offer to come to it.
Well, yeah.
And I remember you would always brag about your office. Now, I don't know if you were still there when I came in 99. However, you were still talking about it.
Well, we got the bums rush. So at that point, I don't know how it took me this long to mention Jack Pennington. So Jack I'll jump ahead and then jump back.
Yeah, that's fine.
So in 97, 96 was a full year as a second in command, I guess. And in 97, John Fraser transferred to an... internet technology capacity for the entire Grand Canyon Natural History Association. And at that point, Pam Fraser, who was in charge of programs and publishing, asked me if I wanted to transition to the director of the Field Institute.
Drum roll, please.
Drum roll. as an acting director.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah, in late 97. And I said, sure. I mean, there was a little horse trading that went on, and but we came to terms, and I took the reins. And
97. For the 98 season.
We were ramping up to the 98 season.
Yeah.
So, and the first thing I did as my first official act as the interim director was one of the best moves I ever made, for the record, and that's to flag down a lanky, red-headed Brit who was working at that point, named Jack Pennington, who had been working for the Park Service, I think, in Re-Veg and an interp, a dogged cyclist. So he would ride to work as long as I knew him, in 3 feet of snow. I mean, he was from, you know, not northern England, but close enough that he loved inclement weather.
Yeah,
it's a badge of honor. And I flagged, I think I bumped into him at Babbitt's, the grocery store, and said, hey, you know, we got to talk. I need a...
Now you need an assistant.
I need an assistant.
Yeah.
So he came in and interviewed down in Kolb's studio, and I hired him on the spot.
Wow.
And we worked on and off, mostly on, for the, you know, next 27 plus years.
Wow.
And so he and I were officed in Kolb's studio until superintendent, I already referenced Rob Armberger, to take people to the fabled dark room of the Kolb brothers, which included a window out the west end of the building looking right down on the Bright Angel Trail, through which they would take photographs of the mule riders on a daily basis, and sometimes the hard way, but in later years, a little bit of an easier way, produce prints of people on mules and sell them back to the tourists at the end of the day. For anybody listening who's ever had a picture taken of them on a roller coaster at Knott's Berry Farm or, you know, Euro Disney, it all started out of a 2.5 by 3 foot opening out the western wall of Kolb Studio.
Yeah.
And but to go access that room for VIPs that schmoozed or hugged their way, you know, through the alarms and out down through the gallery, you'd have to go through our office. And on one of those visits with Superintendent Armberger, on his way back through, he looked at Jack and I with our computers all set up with the best view.
The only view.
The only view from a desk.
Yes.
Over the canyon, including the superintendent's office.
Yes.
Were Jack and I. And he said, and I quote, "How did you guys score this office?" And we laughed, and he played on through, and I looked at Jack, and I'm like, "Let's start packing now."
Oh,
and it took a few weeks, but we ended up relocating to what's now with the inglorious name of the community building, which is well off the rim.
Yeah.
And it's that has its own story. But
which is where I had all of my career as a trail guide in the Grand Canyon.
Yeah. For the Field Institute.
For the Field Institute, yeah.
So yeah, it was a 2.5 year.
You were there that long.
Love affair with the view out the window. Although I will say this, this is proof positive for any researchers out there listening, and you can put electrodes on me to this end. You can get used to anything. You can take anything for granted with familiarity, and here's proof positive. I would have my desk right at the window, with the Grand Canyon out the window off my left shoulder. And if it was a cloudless day with anything going on, I would go home for lunch, and Kim would ask me, "How did the canyon look today?" And my response would be, "I don't know. I didn't even look out the window."
Wow.
And once I started to embrace photography, looking through the same windows that got the Kolb brothers, Ellsworth and Emery, excited about photography, I'm sure. Some, in some ways, carrying on their legacy. But then, you know, any interesting cloud play, I'd be out on their patio taking pictures. But then you get picky, because once you've had 100 shots of a breaking storm, you get a little picky. Pretty soon it was, okay, double rainbow, got one of those, back to work. Double rainbow with a condor, got 3 of those. Oh, double rainbow with a condor with Cocopelli's flute in its beak? Okay, 1 from the hip. No tripod.
But I think it was a little bit of a emotional backward slide to go to the community building. A little bit.
I mean, God.
At least that's what it sounded like to me.
Well, you could see our claw marks across the village with a little break over the railroad tracks. But, yeah,
Frankly, Jack's office went to the community building, but your office went to the old hospital.
There was a whole thing about that.
Remember that.
Yeah, there was the great flood where there was a burst pipe in the dead of night in December that washed out the front.
The Park Service had the upstairs of the community building, and I think you guys were up there for a short time.
Yeah, but let me back up a little bit to community build or Kolb Studio.
Okay.
So what really sealed the deal was this was pre Grand Canyon Association taking on fundraising.
Right.
At that point, the bowels of Kolb Studio became a real donor-friendly destination to give them that insider tour. Before that happened, Pam Fraser, and I think you referenced this earlier, was tasked by the, I don't know if we were the association yet or not, but to refurbish the bowels of Kolb Studio. And I'm going to pull you in a bit because I think you have a story here.
For an art gallery.
Well, art gallery, yes, in what had been the auditorium for the Kolb brothers to show their film for 65 years straight that they shot in 1911/12. Of their trip through the Colorado. The longest running movie in American history.
Yeah.
25 cents a day, two matinees. I never saw it, you probably did.
I've seen bits of it.
Okay, yeah.
The squeaky voice that's talking on the film bothers me.
So he had that 1950s annoying baseball. There he was, yeah there you are. But he was a pretty good natural historian in his own right. He had
you
a
may
lot.
Remember, I met him.
This is Emery Kolb we're talking about.
Yeah. Now. Yeah. I met Emery Kolb.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Back one of my Ranger days.
Well, he got a lot of it right on the film. They put voice on later.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the residential area downstairs, which visitors were not allowed generally to go down to, unless they knew somebody named Mike Buchheit or Wayne Ranney, we were mandated at the History Association to refurbish that with antiques and period pieces, because all of Emery's furniture, when he passed away in 1979, you can correct me, and you just did, anywhere along the way. After he passed away, he hung in there long enough to have the building put on the National Historic Register.
Yeah.
So the Park Service couldn't push it into the canyon, and there were people that were, it wouldn't have been done like that, but he saved his building by hanging in there as long as he did. He died at the age of 95?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the Park Service had this exquisite building at the trailhead and didn't quite know what they were going to do with it. So it sat there for a while.
Yeah.
Through a few...
14 years.
Yeah, through a few assessments and probably no shortage of roundtables, what should we do? And even to drive a nail into a building like that takes, anyone who's worked with the feds knows it's no small task. You need all kinds of sign-offs by historic architects and so forth. But in the interim, they allowed the Grand Canyon Natural History Association to put a bookstore in what had been the Kolb brothers' gift shop. They allowed them to turn the auditorium where the movie was shown into a exhibit area for exhibits. Sounds like you wanted to check, maybe not. And then later in that trajectory was to restore the residential area downstairs with furniture that either had been owned by the Kolbs or had been acquired by a, I'm trying to think of her name.
Aerosmith?
Yeah.
Edie
Aerosmith. Who
I went to college with her.
You're kidding.
Yeah, she was a geology student at NAU.
So, working with Pam Fraser and funding from
This was my weekend supply.
Okay.
Okay.
We're talking about Waterloo sparkling water, of course. So at this point, the funding was coming from one or both of the Grand Canyon National Park Foundation, the original Friends Group for Grand Canyon National Park, ultimately replaced by the Grand Canyon Association when we took on fundraising for the park, and I hope we have time to talk about that, and the Grand Canyon Natural History Association. So we raised money to make this happen. So some beautiful, exquisite furniture from the 20s, 30s, 40s was brought in.
Were you involved with that, buying the furniture?
No.
Okay.
But gone were the days where we could welcome back 10 backpackers caked in mud that hadn't showered in a week, where we could just spread out the folding chairs in Emery's old dining room, hose them down, sell them some logo wear, and debrief. You know, those days were gone. So, and then a few pieces. So basically when Emery passed, this is your cue to correct me when I'm wrong. His daughter Edith, his only child, at that point was living in Sedona?
Yep.
And I've been telling this story, and you always come up. From Sedona, she tasked a couple rangers to kind of be custodians of Kolb Studio while it transitioned, while the park was trying to figure out what to do with it. And sell lock, stock, and barrel furniture?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's mostly right. But before Emery died, he hired a high school buddy of mine named Mark Jeffers to be his caretaker.
Okay.
And Mark was working the December night when Emery had his heart attack and passed away. The daughter in Sedona asked Mark to stay on as now the caretaker of the house until the possessions could be dealt with and the property ownership transferred to the Park Service.
Okay.
So my friend Mark from Pomona, California, where I grew up, had the keys to the house, and a couple of us from California were there at Grand Canyon in 1976 and 77, and we had our way in the house. I mean, we could go in and...
And have your lava lamp,
yep,
the fondue, wife-swapping parties.
Okay. Yeah, and that's... It wasn't rangers, but it was the caretaker, Mark.
Okay.
And there was an estate sale, but Edith said to Mark, if any or you of your friends want to buy any of this stuff before the estate sale. And so Emery's Persian carpet, about as big as this room that we're sitting in at the Embassy Suites.
20 by 20.
It's a literally Persian carpet. Don Webster got that. And he's in Durango, Colorado. And Norm Henderson, who was a resources manager with the National Park Service, got the hutch from Indiana. And just very briefly, before I turn it back to you, Norm lived with that hutch for 30 years and brought it to every national park that he worked at, which was Indiana Dunes and Capitol Reef and Glen Canyon National Recreation Area. And he finally moved to work in Salt Lake City for the Park Service. And one day he said to my wife, Helen, I really don't need this anymore. Do you think they want it back? And he donated it to the Grand Canyon Association. And Emery Kolb's original hutch that was in his kitchen now lives in the Kolb house. And on the back is the postage certificate that actually says delivered to Emery C. Kolb, Grand Canyon, Arizona.
Holy cow.
So I missed a lot of that because in the summer of 77, I was the ranger at Meadview, way out on the west end of Grand Canyon. But all of my friends were there and ended up with a lot of that stuff, which is just a long way to say we're getting back to you now about whatever you want to talk about next in your journey at Grand Canyon.
Well, boy, there's an open-ended question.
Well, we could take a time out and you could interject any story you
before
want.
We do that, I'm going to leave you with the story and then we'll...
Yeah.
And this involves Helen. And,
okay.
And like Jack Pennington, I'm surprised it took us this long to bring up Helen.
Yeah.
Because she
well,
was...
Well, she didn't arrive till 2005.
Yeah, but she is a thread through my whole
yeah.
experience there. And one of the things she, I'm going to just use the phrase, pulled off. She was just, I can't remember what her capacity was then. But one of my top five moments at Grand Canyon was made possible by Wayne's wife, Helen, now wife, Helen.
Wow.
When she, so we mentioned that in the auditorium at Kolb Studio, we were having rotating exhibits. Four or five exhibits. It could be plein air painting. It could be photography. It could be Native American handicrafts and or American Indian handicrafts. I never get that right anymore. But the exhibit that came to be the sort of standing exhibit there now.
Yes.
Is the history of the Kolb family.
Yes.
Emory and Ellsworth that showed up in the early 1900s, shortly after the railroad started to service Grand Canyon Village. Wife Blanche, daughter Edith, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, working with the Park Service and I don't know how many stakeholders and people, probably Klein Library, and it's probably a very long list. We were able to curate and put together a phenomenal, free to the public, you don't want to miss it, exhibit that more often than not is standing in Kolb Studio. Well, in my time there, and I knew, I was privy to this because Kim worked in publishing, my wife Kim, back to Kim. Whenever we being the association, wanted to use a Kolb photo in one of our many, many books that we published. We were one of the few nonprofits that published. It really set us apart. We had every wrinkle on the elephant for a support nonprofit working with the Park Service. Where we would go for permission, to use a Kolb photo, mostly from Emory, who had the longer legacy there, than his older brother Ellsworth, we would send a letter to his grandson, Emory Leonard, also named Emory, obviously. And it was one of the old-fashioned, we'd love to use this photo. If we don't hear from you in 30 days, we'll take that as a yes. This is my recollection.
Okay.
So there was a lot of that going on. Yeah, but we knew where he was moving around the country, and I think he was eventually in Montana.
That's right.
With his wife, her name's escaping me, but she. But anyway, we would invite Emory Leonard, so grandson of Emory Kolb, to everything, you know, almost every event that we would have at Kolb Studio. In general, but in particular, anything that had to do with the family's legacy at Grand Canyon National Park, because you cannot talk about certainly pioneer history forward at Grand Canyon National Park without referencing the Kolb brothers and everything they did. And again, in particular, Emory Sr. In fact, Ken Burns' film, America's Greatest Idea, spent vast amounts of time talking about Grand Canyon through the lens, quote unquote, of the Kolb brothers' experience.
Mm-hmm.
So Helen invited Emory Leonard, and his wife's name will come to me, to come to the 100th anniversary of Kolb Studio. So this would have been 2004. Does that make sense?
Helen wasn't working there in 2004. Okay. It was around 2011 or 12.
Okay.
Maybe 10.
So we found some other century mark too.
Yeah.
But it doubled as No, it was for the open. That's it. I take that back. It was for the opening of this exhibit about the Cole family legacy.
Right. Okay.
She invited them, and they said yes. So they, the family, Emery Leonard, his wife, his granddaughter,
their daughter, Draper, and granddaughter,
and one of their granddaughters, who's I remember her as like a 6'2" twin.
Yes.
So one of the twins came.
Her name begins with R, Rebecca, Rachel, something like
that. Probably Draper, because mom's name is Draper.
Yeah.
So they're all coming, and we're all just giddy.
Jennifer Draper. Great-granddaughter, okay. Rebecca.
So we're all, Ruth was the wife.
Ruth
Leonard.
There you go, you did get it.
Okay, so so they're coming. So it took Helen Ranney to say, to look at the possibilities and say, reached out to the family and said, we are delighted that you're coming. They did ask for a morning alone, as I recall, downstairs in the residential area just to reminisce, because Emery Leonard, the grandson, spent some quality time with his grandparents.
Every summer he was there.
Yeah, Emery and Blanche Kolb in the house. So he was excited to just be there with his family to reconnect with the home, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And the reason this is important, go ahead and collect your thoughts, but the reason this is important is because after Emery's death, and probably even before it, the family was estranged from the park because of Emery's relationship with the park. And they hadn't been back for decades.
Yeah.
And this was a big deal when Emery Leonard and Jennifer and Rachel, Rebecca, whoever came back.
Yeah. Some of you will be smiling when I say this. Emery had a strong personality. I'll leave it at that. I'll leave a tender moment alone. So, so anyway, they wanted the morning alone, but Helen was, I'll say, bold enough to ask, or generous enough to ask in hindsight, would you be willing, family, to spend a few minutes with the rangers, park interpretive rangers, field institute instructors, and assorted others that continue day in and day out to share the family's legacy with park visitors.
Yes.
It would be a golden opportunity for them to learn from your impressions, and they said yes.
Wow.
So we all squeezed into the former, what became the parlor, but was originally the dining room, and I found that out during that talk. So there they were. We had them set up in the corner, big smiles. This guy was Emery Leonard was a born storyteller. The park service, Mike Quinn, did it take us this long to mention Mike Quinn?
Yeah.
He videotaped the whole thing, so the park captured this. 15 minutes turned into, I think, 3 hours. Most of their time that they had negotiated to be down there alone. I think they had the afternoon. And it was golden. For anybody,
I was there.
Oh yeah, that's right. Of course you were. You made the picture at the end.
Yeah.
And I had to cut out, but it was a wide range. It was just very personal. There were some tears for sure.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
Because
your impressions.
Here was this rapprochement between the Cole family and the National Park Service, long overdue. And it was very emotional to be there. And everybody felt it.
Yeah.
And it was fabulous. And I'm so glad you brought that up.
It was cathartic.
That was really a golden moment at Grand Canyon that, you know, that story has now been told. Thank you very much, Mike Buchheit.
Well, my top five moment.
Yeah.
During my time there, if not top three. And I got to talk to Emery Leonard afterwards.
And he passed away a year or two later.
Yeah. But closure.
Yeah.
He came full circle.
It was really great.
But a real quick story, and then we'll take a break.
Okay.
So he was telling the story of, and I'll try to get this right, we'll tag team this one. So if my memory serves, when the Park Service acquired, after Emery Kolb Sr. passed away, the Park Service acquired the house and what had been Emery's garage, but doubled as a place to store boats. And one of the things they found there in one of the boats was a fully articulated male skeleton with a hole in the skull under a tarp. And that whole thing took on a life of its own right through America's Unsolved Mysteries with none other than Jack Palance narrating kind of a hokey story about it being, Emery being involved with a love triangle with Glenn and Bessie Hyde, who went missing in the 29. Okay. But Emery Leonard, grandson Emery, said, I think in the main interview, he said, that was a bunch of hogwash. Everyone knew where that skeleton came from. My grandpa and I found it out by Grandview.
Yep.
And in fact, after dinner in this very room, we would clear the table, which you can, a table you can still see down in that, it's in a different room now. And Grandpa and I and the doctor at the clinic, for fun, would reassemble that skeleton on the dining room table after dinner. And he said, what I can never forget is there was still decaying brain matter in the skull, and it stunk to high heaven. And jeez, talk about a kid memory.
Yeah.
And he went on to become, in his career, a self-taught archaeologist and a ranger. This is Emery Jr. now, the grandson.
Emery Leonard.
And Emery Leonard, at multiple parks. And the last name came from, now I'm really going off, a daughter, Edith, eloping with Ranger Leonard.
Sonny Leonard.
Sonny Leonard, much to the chagrin of Father Emery,
yeah,
who was not fond of the Park Service even back then. So they had a single son.
His daughter married a ranger.
Married a ranger, had one
the
son.
The grandson became a ranger.
Became an Emery, became a ranger.
No wonder he was a personality.
Okay, I think it's time for another...
Okay, we'll take a break here and we'll come back. We got 52 minutes on that one, Mike.